Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There was this outside image of me that I was a Lolita, or I was very mature sexually, but then I became the most famous virgin in the world. So you can imagine my confusion. You can imagine why I needed therapy.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
I'm not afraid of death.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
Is the subject of sex being overexploited by our mass media?
And need to talk about more.
I am a millionaire. It's a weird thing to hear, right?
I'm Anna Sale. Brooke Shields is 50 years old. Her career is 49.
That was my first relationship, was my career. I mean, next to my mom. But I have a very strong, enduring relationship with my career. And I don't plan on divorcing it.
She booked her first national modeling campaign before she was a year old. By 12, Brooke had landed a lead role in the movie Pretty Baby, where she was a child actor playing a child prostitute.
I'm not a child.
Excuse me, that is your opinion.
Then there was Blue Lagoon, the sexy teen romance movie.
Kiss me.
You're all sticky.
So what? Kiss me.
Stop, I can't breathe.
But I don't want to stop.
When she was 15, Brooke became the face of Calvin Klein jeans. It was a controversial campaign.
You want to know what comes between me and my Calvins? Nothing.
Brooke was a sex symbol. But she wasn't having sex. When she wrote her first book in college, she admitted that she was a virgin and then became well known for that.
I was very naive. I had a very strict father and a very strict mother. And I was not aware. I was not sexually aware. And I had no problem talking about it because I wasn't ashamed of it. In fact, I was sort of, you know, proud that I was sort of standing up for myself and because I wasn't afraid.
Sex scared Brooke, but her early work, the film shoots and the modeling gigs, didn't. She remembers feeling safe.
The sort of odd part about it, or the crazy part, was that I was really just a little 13-year-old kid who was so sheltered, who went to regular schools, who, you know, loved horses. And so there were these two kind of, there was a juxtaposition of those two things.
I wonder if now being a mother to young girls, has it changed how you think about the work that you did when you were a young woman and the question of consent?
I mean, it's a really good question. I think having children just changes everything that you think of. But what I've really learned to appreciate is that I cannot compare them to me. I think it's a very different era right now. I mean, I wouldn't want my children now to be in this industry at all. Hmm. It's borderline toxic for if you are not of a certain, you know, mental and physical constitution, if you don't have the right surrounding people around you. But when I was younger, I felt like I did have more control because it was just my mother and myself.
Brooke's mom, Terry, was always there with her. Brooke's parents split up not long after she was born, and her mom managed her career. How old were you when you were the prime breadwinner for your family, for you and your mom?
Oh, God, from 11 months till 29. I mean, it was really, that was it. I mean, it was, you know, I always used to say to my mom, like, I wish she had taken a salary because it would have been clearer. Had she had taken a salary, the thing is, you know, it was sort of all mine. But, you know, we bought houses, we bought cars, and, you know, we weren't also not very well advised that you probably shouldn't have six homes in one time. We didn't have anybody saying, you know, you should probably sell this before you do that. And we didn't, you know, people wanted, you know, people said, yes, you find the person that sort of says, sure, yeah, okay, I can do that. You know, but I was, without my working, we didn't have an income.
While she was working, Brooke was also trying to manage her mom's alcoholism. Brooke organized the first intervention to get her mom to rehab when she was 13. It didn't take.
When she was drunk, she was nasty. You know, and it's hard. It's funny because people always say, well, have you forgiven her? It's sort of like I forgave her the minute after she ever said anything unkind. It was almost like the split second because somewhere in my bones, I knew she loved me. And she would ruin things and I would get angry. But you can't get angry for someone for being weak and incapable. And she damaged almost every relationship she had. She cut almost everybody off. And I was the only thing left. But I don't resent it because I concurrently made a life so that no matter what she was going through, I didn't have to take it personally. And I could still love her and I knew and she could still love me. Somewhere along the line, that became my defense mechanism and I stuck to it and I think it helped me.
When you were 29, you separated from her professionally, financially, and as far as who was going to manage your career. Do you wish you'd done that earlier?
I definitely wish I had done that earlier. I was sort of beholden to her and so afraid and had no other people in my life that I could go to and trust because those bridges had been burned. And I think if I had had the guts to maybe not at teenager age, but definitely pretty soon after that, if I'd had the guts and the strength to leave her and get the proper professional guidance, I think it would have been a wise career move. And it might have even been better personally with the two of us. But I was scared. I was too weak. I didn't see a way out, to be honest.
Brooke says it was her first husband, tennis star Andre Agassi, who helped her find that way out. One weekend, behind her mother's back, Brooke had their entire business office packed up and shipped to her new home in Las Vegas. The legal wrangling afterward, between mother and daughter, went on for years. Do you remember when your finances were finally separated from your mom's, what the first major purchase was that you bought for yourself?
Oh, God, I don't think I bought anything for a really long time.
Really?
Really.
Were you afraid to spend money?
I wasn't in a very celebratory mood. You know, yeah. I wasn't really. There was a lot that needed to be sold and tied up and legal fees and stuff like that I really had to assume. I mean, I really had to do all of that. So my whole thing was just, you know, actually it was spending money on her, on getting her her house sold, getting her in a facility that could keep her healthy. That's where all the money just started getting doled out to.
So you spent money on her, but you were also setting her up to not need you.
Need me. I just wanted to get her in a position so that I could know that there was whatever was being dipped into was hers and was going to last. So that I could then just sort of start earning money again. Because I really needed to, I kind of started at zero again. You know, a lot of people start then.
So, yeah, you were just turning 30.
I was just turning
30.
That's
when many careers begin.
It was all fine. I just, you know, one cancels out and the other one starts over.
Coming up, Brooke talks about her struggle to adapt to motherhood and how her postpartum depression impacted her second marriage.
I'm saying to him, you don't understand, you don't understand, you don't understand. And he doesn't. He can't. There's no possible way he can. But he's part of the byproduct of it, and he is a casualty of it.
I mentioned in the Death, Sex, and Money newsletter that I was spending the holidays in California. I was holidaying with family, but I was also doing some fact-finding for a big life change in 2016. In about 6 months, Arthur and I are going to leave New York City and move to the Bay Area. He's going to be joining the faculty at UC Berkeley. I'm very proud. And I'm going to be opening the West Coast headquarters for Death, Sex, and Money. This means I'll be leaving New York City after 7 years, the longest I've lived anywhere since college. A lot has happened while I've lived here. So I'm in one of those weird moments in life when you know everything is about to completely change, but it hasn't yet. And I need some music to go along with it. So we're making a list of the songs that have been your anthems during moments of big transition. For me, I spent the summer before I went to college scream singing the song Wide Open Spaces by the Dixie Chicks while I drove around in my Dodge Shadow. For our producer Chester, it was Common People by Pulp, which he listened to while working up the nerve to quit a desk job that he hated. Now you know why Pulp is his favorite band. So we're building this playlist over the next few months. You can find the link on our Death, Sex, and Money Facebook page. It can be the soundtrack for my move and for whatever else you have coming up this year. Speaking of big leaps, base jumper and wingsuit flyer Jeb Corliss is on the next episode. We talk about his many brushes with death and how he learned to deal with fear when he was a kid getting bullied.
I never saw school as a place to go to learn something. It was a battlefield. It was a place I went to go to war. I got a real understanding of fear real early in life and what fear was and how to not only control fear within myself, but once I learned how to kind of harness fear and understand it, then I learned how to control it to when you're getting attacked by 10 people, you know, you can't win physically.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Brooke Shields married comedy writer and producer Chris Hinchey in 2001. They immediately started trying to have a baby. Brooke was 35, and she found she needed IVF.
I sort of jumped in with humor. You know, well, I'm going to go get my eggs today. Tell you how they look. You know, the hen's going to go lay them. You know, whatever the thing was, because that would be my thing. That was my shtick, you know. In a very strange way, it made me feel like I was a normal person who had struggles. And I think all my life I have tried to a fault to prove that I'm not better than anybody else. So then all of a sudden I had this struggle and I thought, oh, this is great. People identify with me now. Mm. But then what happens is then more and more of your friends start getting pregnant and having babies, and you're still the one not. Or you lose your first child, or by the time I got to my sixth IVF, then I started to get a little bitter. Hmm. And that's when I kind of shut down and didn't talk about it anymore.
How many miscarriages did you have?
I had just one pregnancy and miscarriage at 3 months. It was the first attempt. So I got pregnant in the first attempt. And so I had this unbelievable sense of it was just going to be a great thing. And then 3 months into it, was told it was an unviable pregnancy and then had to basically, give birth. That was when I kind of got. Like losing the first one was the thing that changed me more than the whole process did.
Yeah.
You know, just, and you sort of, it is a very lonely, even if you talk to people that have gone through it, even with your partner or spouse or whoever, like it was interesting. It was only the dog that I would allow be in the room with me. Hmm. Because she just sat at my feet and she would sort of slowly come up and lick my face and then go back down because it took it took through the night. And I remember waking up thinking, well, I'm definitely not a kid anymore. You know, I was older emotionally and just psychically. I was just an older person the next morning.
When Brooke did eventually get pregnant again, it almost felt unexpected after so many tries. And she was thrilled.
It was like birds were flying around my head when I was pregnant.
Her daughter's birth wasn't easy. After 24 hours of labor, Brooke needed an emergency C-section.
You know, my uterus was like blown out of the water on the table and my, you know, the baby's got her cord wrapped around her four times and the doctor's telling me, you know, you may die, so we've taken precautions. It was just all very, I was just very angry at everything. And then just felt inept and didn't realize that I was just very unhealthy, you know, chemically, biochemically.
When did you realize that something was wrong?
It took me a while. It took me about, it was at least between 3 and 5 weeks of just being so miserable and unhappy and scared and just out of my body and not, you know, and having everybody tell me one thing. You know, one person's telling me to stop breastfeeding. The other person's telling me to do this. The other person's telling me. Everybody's got a solution. And, you know, you go to the doctor so many times when you have a newborn. You go every week and it's all about the baby. You know, if they say, how are you? And you say, oh, you know, I've been crying or it's been hard. They say, oh, it'll pass. You'll get over it. You know, it's the baby blues or you're tired. You're, you know, your body's going through a lot. And it just, I just kept going darker and darker and darker. You know, I saw my baby going, hitting the wall, like being flung across the room.
You visualized that.
I visualized it. I didn't want to be the doing it. But I would sit there, I'd close my eyes, and these horrible things, these images would come through my mind. On one visit to the doctor for my daughter, I took the doctor aside and I said, can I talk to you for a second? And he said, yes. I said, I've made a terrible mistake. I really can't do this. You have to figure it out. I need to figure out something to do. You know, it wasn't about giving up the baby. It was just, what do you do when you've made a horrible mistake and you can't handle something? Like, I was like, I can't do this. I thought I could. I was stupid. I should have learned that, you know, I couldn't have children naturally, so that must have been a sign, and I should have never played with fate. And I felt like I was dying. I wanted to disappear. I just wanted to separate myself from the situation and pretend it never happened and I wasn't in it. And you know, and even if I had to go far away and figured she'd be fine, you know, everybody that was normal would be fine and they could take care of her. And like, it was just a very rational hysteria.
The doctor asked if Brooke would consider taking medication for postpartum depression. That infuriated Brooke.
You know, I'm not depressed. I'm not broken.
Then her husband asked her to consider it. So she started taking an antidepressant. The first drug didn't work, but after a couple of tries, she found a combination that seemed to help.
I then decided that that would be a perfect time to go off everything cold turkey, because that was a brilliant idea that I had.
Because you were fixed.
Because I was fixed. And clearly, it wasn't the medication, because I had taken all these other medications, and then this was just no different. I just happened to have been, you know, got better. Or got something. So I went off cold turkey, hit a very bad, bad, bad relapse. But it was the first thing that made me realize that what I had was a real thing. It was a real affliction, a biochemical shift that needed to be addressed. Whereas prior to that, I was thinking I had much more control over it and that I was just a failure.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that it was much easier to accept that it was your failure to be an adequate mother than it was that you had something happening with your brain chemistry.
Oh, absolutely. Because, see, if the psychology of that for me was, I've never been normal. Ever since I was a baby, I was sort of singled out as something. Then I was this. Then I had a really non-conventional life. And then all of a sudden, so by the time I got to this, I thought, oh, of course, of course. You didn't listen in the beginning. You didn't. You had to try. You had to have a baby. You had to be normal. What were you thinking? And then, of course, I'm not equipped to be a mother. I had an alcoholic mother. I didn't, you know, I wasn't normal. So it would make sense that I would then ruin another little child's life. You know, those are all the poisonous, toxic thoughts that actually very clearly and rationally speak to you when you have postpartum depression.
Did it make you nervous and scared to try to have a second baby?
No, because in my third trimester, I balanced myself hormonally. I took the right medicine. I did everything to fortify.
You were public about your struggles with postpartum depression nearly almost as it was happening. Within 2 years after the birth, you'd written a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
How have you talked to your daughter about that time?
I've had to really make sure that I don't give her too much information because she's 12.
Yeah.
So, you know, my tendency in my brain is to want to sit down and really talk about all of it. And then you look at her and you're like, she's 12. She doesn't want to hear about your uterus. Like, she's not interested. In your ovaries, she's not interested. She wants Instagram or candy. You know, it's like, so it's, she doesn't, like, there's no real, I don't think they're really ready to talk about it. You know, I have to be really, really careful. And so I also can't make my struggles hers. You know, I can't, that was something I really did go through, and she has absolutely no part in it. You know, no fault of hers. There's nothing that she did, but if you don't word it right at the right time, it could be interpreted that she was somehow responsible for my misery. You know what I mean? And I think that you have to be really careful with not making your problems their problems.
Brooke's getting daily reminders of that now that her oldest daughter is almost a teenager.
I was trying to get her out to school today, and there's a sort of inordinate amount of time that she's standing in front of the mirror. And she's just posing kind of and doing this with her hair and fixing herself. I was like, can we get out? The bus is coming. Can we please get out of the house? And I said, you look fine. Your hair looks fine. Can we please go? And as I was walking to the bus, I thought, my God, I used to fall in dance class because I couldn't look at myself, because everybody else had looked at me so much. And part of me is envious of her. Part of me is, you know, is angry that I couldn't do that as a kid. And then part of me is so proud that she feels that she is able to do that, and I want to nurture that. But I have to remember she's not me. So I'm instantly, you talk about it, it's like, I don't know how to deal with a person like that. That's self-confidence. I don't know what they do. You know,
you do know she has to catch the bus.
Yeah. I know she has to. And I also don't want her to be vain. So I'm trying to go, like, stop staring at yourself. Get out of the house. But it just all came kind of in at one moment. And I think that, we also, as a parent, your ego is so fragile. And, you know, I want their approval all the time, you know, and I'm also, you know, I'm in competition with her for her father's attention. It's ridiculous.
Around the time that Brooke's second daughter was born, Brooke's mom started showing signs of dementia. After a long deterioration, Terry Shields died in 2012. Do you ever have flashes of anger at her still?
I have flashes of anger a lot, but I'm pissed off at her for not being able to stick around and watch. My kids are hysterical. They're so funny. We've really built the life that I had always wanted to build. So it's that kind of stuff. And then I sit there and I think, you know, it's a shame she wasn't as strong as you are. You know, she didn't like herself as much. You know, she didn't learn to love herself enough to take care of herself. I couldn't do that for her. Like, you can't do that for someone else. That's the stuff that just kind of pisses you off. And you've got no control over it.
So you're 50 years old. When you think about where you are in your career, what are you excited to do?
I'm excited now to have even more energy going forward. You know, I'm producing more. I realize I have actually earned my opinions. And I think it really took, I think I had to become this age, and I think I had to lose my mother before I really could come into my own and not be waiting constantly to be picked or approved of or chosen or in the crowd going, oh, I can do this, I can do this. Instead now, I don't know, there was a shift that happened and it's on my terms. You know, so now it's about what do I want to do? How do I want to spend my day?
Why do you think losing your mom led to that shift?
Because even though she wasn't present in my daily life, everything was done with her in my mind. It was either I was trying to run away from her or I was running towards her. I was trying to fix her or I was trying to find someone else to fix her. I was trying to keep her alive or hiring someone else to keep her alive. I was, every time the phone rang, I thought I was going to be a healthcare professional. You know, everything, there's that sort of vice that is on your chest, especially if you're a single child. There's no other relatives. It was me and that's it. And everything I did, I thought, okay, better, you know, I got to call today. I got to go visit today. I have to go. And there is this preoccupation and you're watching someone just absolutely deteriorate and you still have so much to do every day with it. And I can't have it anymore. It's not there. Like, that's not a part of my day anymore. And with that time, I took that for myself.
Is it hard for you to share money now in your family, given what you went through with your mom?
Wait, what do you mean? Like with my kids?
With your husband, like figuring out finances.
No, like, you know, it's really funny. Well, it's not funny. It's actually very embarrassing. I am having my first real, now I've had these meetings with my accountants and lawyers since I was a kid, but I can't say I've ever really read through a document. And it wasn't until after my mom died, again, I don't know what it was, that I started reading all the fine print. You know, it's weird. Before you're 50, you're sort of still, you can still go, oh, I'm in my these years, and I'm in, and I got those people are good, and I trust them, and da da da. And you know, there's all these little bubbles that you can kind of put yourself in, and you don't really have to be aware of the boring, horrible, scary, terrifying nature of money, right? So it's just recently, and tomorrow afternoon, I have my first sort of really proactive, I called it fully cognizant, fully aware, have read all the documents, even know the numbers. Tomorrow, and I'm 50. Like
a financial planning meeting.
A financial planning meeting where I pay attention. I've had financial meetings before, and I tell you, I can't wait to get out of there. And I'm actually going to walk in there like an executive producer that I am.
That
now.
You are.
That I am now. I'm going to bring a clipboard.
That's Brooke Shields. She wrote a book about her mother called There Was a Little Girl. It's just out in paperback. And she's executive producing and acting in a new TV series called Flower Shop Mystery. Brooke says it's like Murder, She Wrote, but in a flower shop. So all you Jessica Fletcher fans, find it on Hallmark's Mystery Channel. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios. The team includes Katie Bishop, Chester Jesus Soria, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death, Sex, Money. And you can email us anytime with your stories or your feedback at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. And do us a favor, if you like the show, give us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the show, and we like to read them. Brooke Shields says another thing that's changed since her mother's death is her sex life. She says her mom could make her feel guilty about sex, even with her husband.
I'm reveling in it. more because I don't feel like I have to apologize. I have to apologize to him for certain things. I had carpal tunnel, and people were saying, you know, well, how did you get it? And my husband's like, I'll tell you how she didn't get it.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.